Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Hey. Welcome to the Talking Show on K Chung Radio, Chinatown's only micro broadcasting radio station. My name is Nicholas Miller.
Hey.
And I'm here with my tireless co-host, Steve Cato. Why don't you say hi, Steve Cato?
Hi there, everyone out there in Radio Land. Hi, Nicholas. And we've got something real weird today, don't we?
That's right. Well, we've had a couple people write in from the last show. People were a little confused by Wallace Shawn's first reading. In particular, there was one subject that was deeply troubling to many of our listeners. And so we've gone ahead and done something unprecedented here on the Talking Show. We've invited a specialist to come discuss this very problem that Wallace Shawn is trying to deal with. So the problem that we're talking about is commodity fetishism, which is a subject that comes up in Karl Marx's seminal text, Capital, Volume 1. So here we have Itzo Cash to discuss commodity fetishism. Welcome, Itzo.
Hello, Nicholas and Steve. Thank you for having me on today. Once upon a time, Nicholas got his tongue burnt on coffee. They brought it out in a kind of science experiment, as if it was a science experiment to burn tongues.
Right. I do remember that, Itzo. Right. And if memory serves me, I recall being offered a selection of coffees from all different countries all over the world. And I can remember only half jokingly saying to the barista, give me the coffee from the most oppressed country. And I feel like your anecdote gets right to the heart of commodity fetishism, but I'd like for you to maybe to expand a little bit for some of our listeners out there. Could you do that?
Well, it's true, Nicholas. I have been wondering when they will start selling graffiti supplies at the wine shop.
Right. I don't fully understand how that relates, Itzo. I'm sorry, Mr. Cash.
I think that one of the difficulties with Marx's writing is that he had a real taste for and capacity for a rhetorical flourish that sometimes outstrips the intention of the text. We see this in the section of Capital on commodity fetishism, which begins with a description of exchange relations as being like a table turned upside down and dancing. And this gives us the impression of exchange relations in general as being a fantastical illusion. In fact, however, the effects of commodity fetishism are far from illusory. It is an abstract force which has real effects in the organization of social life.
Right. Steve, do you have anything to add to that?
I feel entirely baffled by that explanation. Maybe even more so than I was by Marx, who I actually didn't find that confusing in the original. Boy, Itzo. You're really tripping me out here, dude.
Well, thanks, Mr. Cash, for being here for the introduction, and hopefully we'll see you afterwards. Well, I think we're going to get right to it, and we'll hopefully have Mr. Cash stick around till the end of the episode to talk a little bit more, although I know how much he likes those Chinese dumplings over there in Chinatown, so we'll see if he makes it back in time. Either way, here we have, for one more week, Wallace Shawn.
Look, here's a question I'd like to ask you. Have you ever had any friends who were poor? See, I think that's an idea a lot of people have. Why shouldn't I have some friends who are poor? I've pictured it so often, like a dream that comes again and again. There have been so many people who work at menial jobs whom I've seen every day. People who've caught my eye, talked to me, and I've thought, how nice, it's nice, if only. And I've imagined it. But then what I imagine always ends so badly. I always picture that they invite you to come over to their home for dinner, and I don't know what it is. It's something about the light bulbs, the flooring that's coming up just a tiny little bit from the floor, and you walk in and you say to yourself, it's fine. This is fine. It's all just fine. But you know it isn't. And there's a sort of sticky smell coming from somewhere, from a hallway, a room, and the television, and the walls are painted with this kind of shiny pink, and there are children who are sick and sneezing and coughing, and there are some hard chairs, and you end up sitting on the floor. And you're squirming around on the floor, and you're trying to find some support for your back. And they give you some food, and the meat is greasy, and the piece of meat seems to get bigger and bigger as it sits on your plate. And everyone's being incredibly nice, and somebody changes the baby's diaper. Then a week later, they call and invite you again, and you don't know what to say. So you go once again, and then once again, maybe a few months later, and then, I don't know, maybe you've moved to another part of town. Maybe you've moved out of town altogether. Maybe they've moved out of town. But the next time you go is a year later. And then there never is a time after that. Dear God, what's happening to me? I feel like there's nothing left of me. I feel like I don't think anything. I don't remember. What are the things I always say? I believe that there... I believe that the... No, now stop that. Every person is a person. Every person believes certain things. My friend Bob believes that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others. And Fred believes that today's rebel is tomorrow's dictator. And Natasha believes that peasants in poor countries just want to be left alone to farm their fields in peace and quiet, and they couldn't care less about the ideologies of the right or the left. Mario believes that social criticism in plays and films can be expressed most effectively through the use of humor. And Indrani believes that works of art, including performances of opera and ballet, can change individuals and through them, society. And Toshiko believes that the only real contribution that people can make towards solving the problems of the world is to raise their own families with good values. And Anne-Marie believes that the rich and the poor should live as friends and should work together to make the future better than the past. But the question is, would it really matter if it were Fred rather than Bob who believed that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others? What if Fred were to wake up one morning and think he believed that, forgetting that that was actually the belief of his friend Bob? Fred believes certain things. You can say that, but what does it mean? Does it mean something? I don't remember. And my beliefs. Yes, I have beliefs. Yes, I believe in humanity, sympathy for others. I oppose cruelty and violence. What? You applaud cruelty and violence? No, I said I oppose cruelty and violence. Jesus Christ, oppose. But I can still remember what I like, can't I? If not what I believe, I know what I like. I like warmth, coziness, pleasure, love, presence, mail, nice plates, those paintings by Matisse. Yes, I'm an aesthete. I like beauty. Yes. Poor countries are beautiful. Poor people are beautiful. It's a wonderful feeling to have money in a country where most people are poor. To ride in a taxi through horrible slums. Yes, a beggar can be beautiful. A beggar can have beautiful lips, beautiful eyes. You're far from home. To you, her simple shawl seems elegant, direct, the right way to dress. You see her approaching from a great distance. She's old, thin, and yes, she looks sick, very sick, near death, but her face is beautiful, seductive, luminous. You think you like her. You're drawn to her. Yes, you think there's money in your purse. You'll give her some of it. And a voice says, why not all of it? Why not give her all that you have? Be careful. That's a question that could poison your life. Your love, your love of beauty could actually kill you. If you hear that question, it means you're sick. You're mentally sick. You've had a breakdown. And the bathroom spins all the way around at a sort of unbearable speed. I stare at the toilet. Answer the question, idiot. Don't just stand there. I can't give the beggar all that I have because wait a minute. Wait a minute. I have beliefs. There's a reason why I won't give the beggar all of my money. Yes, I'm going to give her some of it. I always give away quite a surprising amount to people who have less than I do. But there's a reason why I'm the one who has the money in the first place, and that's why I'm not going to give it all away. In other words, for God's sake, I worked for that money. I worked hard. I worked hard to make that money. And it's my money because I made it. I made the money, and so I have it, and I can spend it any way I like. This is the basis of our entire lives. Why can I stay here in this hotel? Because I paid to stay here with my money. I paid to stay here. I paid to be served. That entitles me to certain things. I'm entitled to stay here. I'm entitled to be served. I'm entitled to expect that certain things will be done. Now, this morning, for example, the chambermaid left my room a mess. The floor was dirty. There were no clean sheets. The waste paper basket was left full. So I paid to stay here. I paid to be served. I'm entitled to service. But the chambermaid didn't serve me properly. That was wrong. And I'm seized by another fit of vomiting. My shoulders reach forward toward the toilet and pull me with them. My head drives toward the bowl of the toilet, and I vomit again and again and again. Why is the old woman sick and dying? Why doesn't she have money? Didn't she ever work? You idiot. You pathetic idiot. Of course she worked. She worked 16 hours a day in a field, in a factory. She worked. The chambermaid worked. You say you work. Well, why does your work bring you so much money while their work brings practically nothing? You say you make money. What a wonderful expression. But how can you make so much of it in such a short time? Well, in the same amount of time, they make so little. Heat runs all over me in little waves, and the purple of my bath mat gets deeper and deeper. Enormous fat water bugs cover the floor, running fast. Hundreds of them running in patterns. I stand up to avoid them, and a tall revolutionary guard in an undershirt is lifting his foot. He's lifting his foot, and then he twirls around, and he kicks me in the face. And I fall backward, and I land on a bunk, a hard bunk. And I'm in a cell, and the guard reaches into a big bag, and he pulls out this slim little book, and it's vaguely familiar. And then he throws it at me and leaves the cell. Read it, he says. Read it. Read it. I run to the door of the cell and I scream, "Is this what you call the power of the people?" But he's gone away. I scream and scream till my throat aches. But now I'm alone with the ugly little book. My hands drip with sweat as I sit on the bunk and start to read. Sure, it's just exactly what I expected it to be. The most tedious questions answered in full, as if a person's life were a customs form. Chapter 1. What country I grew up in, what city, what street. My parents' origins, the color of their skin, how much money they made, what I was fed, what I was taught. Chapter 2. This is unbelievable. Printed in the book. Washes hair every day unless in a hurry, quote unquote. When meeting friends for dinner or going to the theater, takes a bath in the late afternoon, puts on fresh clothes. What in the world is going on? This has absolutely nothing to do with what I am like, with anything at all that's important about me. Don't they know that everything in this book is just as true of my neighbor Gene as it is of me? Huh, my neighbor Gene, who makes jokes about starving children in Asia? My neighbor Gene, who boasts about fucking colleagues at the office on the boardroom table? Don't they know that? One of the guards holds my arms behind my back. The other one starts hitting me in the face with his fists. He hits me in the face several times, then in the chest, then in the stomach. No one in my life has ever hit me before. I'm thinking about the damage each blow might do, and a little bit of blood is coming out of my mouth. Then there's another guard, a woman whose face is like a cake that's been soaked in rage. She's standing to the side, and my cries are echoing in the cell. No! No! And then she comes up to me, and she spits in my face. And I'm screaming out at her, "For God's sake, what have I done to make you feel like this? What in the world have I done to you?" When the guards leave, I cry like an animal. I can't stop thinking about my mother, the way she took care of me. I can't stand this. I control myself. I get a grip on myself. I have to survive. And so I sit on my bunk and cry and read and cry and read. Time passes, so much time. Seems like forever. And then, yes, yes, yes. I understand. I see that there's an answer to the question I asked. Yes, it could have been predicted from knowing these things: where I was born, how I was raised, what an hour of my labor would probably be worth. Even though to me, from the inside, my life always felt like a story, it was just unfolding, unpredictable. Yes, I was born, and a field was provided, a piece of land from which rich fruit could be plucked by eager hands, and I was taught to be very eager. The beggar, the chambermaid, of course, if you knew their childhood village. No, they weren't taught to be eager. Here's your land, your piece of land. It was barren, black, uncultivable. And I see the whole world laid out like a map in four dimensions, all the land, the people, the moments of time, today, yesterday. And at each particular moment, I can see that the world has a certain very particular ability to produce the things that people need. There's a certain quantity of land that's ready to be farmed, a certain particular number of workers, a certain stock of machinery, a stock of ideas about how to do things, how to organize all the ones who will work. And each day's capacity seems somehow so small. It's fixed, determinate. Every part of it is fixed. And I can see all the days that have happened already. And on each one of them, a determinate number of people worked, and a determinate portion of all the Earth's resources was drawn up and used, and a determinate little pile of goods was produced, so small. Across the grid of infinite possibility, this finite capacity distributed each day. And of all the things that might have been done, which were the ones that actually happened? The holders of money determine what's done. They bid their money for the things they want, and each one according to the amount they hold. And each bit of money determines some fraction of the day's activities. So those who have a little determine a little, and those who have a lot determine a lot, and those who have nothing determine nothing. And then the world obeys the instructions of the money to the extent of its capacity, and then it stops. It's done what it can. The day is over. Certain things happened. If money was bid for jewelry, then there was silver that was bent into the shape of a ring. If it was bid for opera, there were costumes that were sewn and chandeliers that were hung on invisible threads. And there's an amazing moment. Each day, before the day starts, before the market opens, before the bidding begins, there's a moment of confusion. The money is silent. It hasn't yet spoken. Its decisions are withheld, poised, perched, ready. Everyone knows the world will not do everything today. If food is produced for the hungry children, then certain operas will not be performed. If certain performances are in fact given, then the food won't be produced and the children will die. I pull myself over to the window. It doesn't have bars, and I stick my head out. I like weeping in the warm wind. But I feel the presence of a friend behind me sitting on my bunk smoking quietly. And wait, it's that guard. And so I can't help impulsively speaking and saying, "Look, I'm a human being. Yes, of course I want to make a good wage. What do you think a human being is? A human being happens to be an unprotected little wriggling creature, a little raw creature without a shell or a hide or even any fur, just thrown out onto the earth like an eye that's been pulled from its socket, like a shucked waster that's trying to crawl along the ground. We need to build our own shells. Yes, shoes, chairs, walls, floors, and for God's sake, yes, a little solace. A little consolation, because, Jesus Christ, you know, we wanted to be happy. We wanted our lives to be absolutely great. We were looking forward for so long to some wonderful night in some wonderful hotel, some wonderful breakfast set out on a tray. We were looking forward like panting dogs slobbering on the rug. How we would delight the ones we loved with our kisses in bed. How we would delight our parents with our great accomplishments. How we would delight our children with toys and surprises. But it was all wrong. It was never really right. The hotel, the breakfast, what happened in bed, our parents, our children. So yes, we need solace. We need consolation. We need nice food. We need nice things to wear. We need beautiful paintings, movies, plays, drives in the country, bottles of wine. There's never enough solace. Never enough consolation. I'm doing whatever I possibly can. I try to be nice. I try to be lighthearted, entertaining, funny. I tell entertaining stories to people. I make jokes to the janitor every single morning, to the parking lot attendant every single morning. I try to be amusing whenever I can be to help my friends get through the day. I write little notes to people I like when I enjoy the articles they've written or their performances in the theater. When a group of people at a party were making unpleasant comments about advertising men, I steered the conversation to a different topic because my friend Monica was feeling uncomfortable because her father works as an advertising man. The bunk is empty except for the book. but the pages of the book run with blood as I pick it up, soaking my clothes, spilling over the floor. There's still the preface. Everything that happened before I was born. The voluptuous field that was given to me. How did I come to be given that one? And not the one that was black and barren. Yes, it happened like that, because before I was born, the fields were apportioned. And some of the fields were pieced together. Not by chance. Not by fate. The fields were pieced together one by one by thieves, by killers. Over years, over centuries, night after night, knives glittering, throats cut again and again. Until the beautiful Christmas morning we woke up, and our proud parents showed us the gorgeous, shining, blood-soaked fields which now were ours. Cultivate, they said. Husband everything you pull from the earth. Guard, save. Then give your own children the next hillside, the next valley. From each advantage, draw up more. Grow, cultivate, preserve, guard. Drive forward till you have everything. The others will always fall back. Retreat. Give you what you want. Or sell you what you want for the price you want. They have no choice because they're sick and weak. They've become the poor. And the book runs on. Years, centuries, till the moment comes when our parents say, the time of apportionment is now over. We have what we need, our position well defended from every side. Now, finally, everything can be frozen just as it is. The violence can stop. From now on, no more stealing, no more killing. From this moment, an eternal silence, the rule of law. So, we have everything, but there's one difficulty we just can't overcome, a curse. We can't escape our connection to the poor. We need the poor. Without the poor, to get the fruit off the trees, to tend the excrement under the ground, to bathe our babies on the day they're born, we couldn't exist. Without the poor to do awful work, we would spend our lives doing awful work. If the poor were not poor, if the poor were paid the way we're paid, we couldn't afford to buy an apple, a shirt. We couldn't afford to take a trip to spend a night at an inn in a nearby town. But the horror is that the poor grow everywhere like moss, grass, and we can never forget the time when they owned the land. We can never forget the death of their families, those vows of revenge screamed out in those rooms that were running with gore. And the poor don't forget. They live on their rage. They eat rage. They want to rise up and finish us and wipe us off the earth as soon as they can. And so, in our frozen world, our silent world, we have to talk to the poor. Talk, listen, clarify, explain. They want things to be different. They want change. And so we say, yes, change. But not violent change. Not theft. Not revolt. Not revenge. Instead, listen to the idea of gradual change. Change that will help you, but that won't hurt us. Morality, law, gradual change. We explain it all, a two-sided contract. We'll give you things, many things. But in exchange, you must accept that you don't have the right just to take what you want. We're going to give you wonderful things. Sit down, wait. Don't try to grab. The most important thing is patience, waiting. We're going to give you much, much more than you're getting now, but there are certain things that must happen first. These are the things for which we must wait. First, we have to make more, and we have to grow more, so more will be available for us to give. Otherwise, if we give you more, we'll have less. When we make more and we grow more, we can all have more. some of the increase can go to you. But the other thing is, once there is more, we have to make sure that morality prevails. Morality is the key. Last year we made more and we grew more, but we didn't give you more. All of the increase was kept for ourselves. That was wrong. The same thing happened the year before and the year before that. We have to convince everyone to accept morality and next year give some of the increase to you. So, we all have to wait. And while we're waiting, we have to be careful because we know you. We know there are some who are the violent ones, the ones who won't wait. These are the destroyers. Their children are dying sick, no medicine, no food, nothing on their feet, no place to live, vomiting on the streets. These are the ones who are drunk with rage, with their lust for revenge. We know what they've planned. We've imagined it all 1,000 times. We imagine it every single day. That sound at the door, that odd crack, the splintering sound. Then they break through the lock and run in, yelling, pull us up from where we're gathered at the family table having our meal. Pull our old parents out from the bathroom. Pull the little ones up from their beds. Then they line us all up together in the hall, slap us, kick us, curse us, scream at us. Our parents bleeding, our children bleeding, pulling the children's clothes from the closets, the toys from the shelves, ripping the pictures off the walls. What will they do to us, we ask each other. What? Are they giving all the homes to people who now are living in the street? Then terrible stories, shops torn apart, random killing. The old professor given a new job, cleaning toilets at the railroad station. It seems impossible. Can that possibly have happened? A mob of criminals or unemployed louts, people who a year ago were starving in slums? Are they going to be running the factories now? The schools, everything, the whole country, the whole world? We have to prevent it. Although the violent ones are everywhere already, teaching the poor that the way things are is not God-given. The world could be run for their benefit. And so, we have to set up a special classroom for the poor to teach the poor some bloody lessons from the past. All the crimes committed by the violent rebels, by the followers of Marx, shove the lessons of history down their throats. History, history. The crimes, the oppression, the famines, the disasters. Teach the poor that they must never try to seize power for themselves because the rule of the poor will always be incompetent and it will always be cruel. The poor are bloodthirsty, uneducated, they don't have the skills. For their own sake, it must never happen. And they must understand that the dreamers, the idealists, the ones who say that they love the poor will all become vicious killers in the end. And the ones who claim they can create something better will always end up by creating something worse. The poor must understand these essential lessons, chapters from history. And if they don't understand them, they must all be taken out and shot. Inattention or lack of comprehension cannot be allowed. And in places where we find that the classroom is avoided, we must warn the poor that even the innocent are going to get hurt. We can't accept violence against the symbols of law, the soldiers, the police. We have to kill the ones who commit those crimes. But if the violence goes on for a long time, and the ones whose older sisters and brothers we've already killed may be so full of rage that they don't fear death. And to control those people, we may have to go farther, cut out their tongues, cut up their faces, force them to watch us torture their parents, watch the soldiers rape their children. It's the only way to control people who don't fear death. and so we'll teach the poor that yes, yes, we're going to give them things, but we will decide how much we'll give and when, because we're not going to give them everything. And now the ugly little book is back at chapter 1, and I read it again. Chapter 2, and I read it again. And the water bugs still cover the floor, running in the same complicated patterns, but I brush a few aside and lie down among them. I listen to the strange pounding in my ears, and it's as if a voice like vomit is coming up slowly from my throat. Stop! Everyone has always been so good to me. No. Listen. I want to tell you something. You've misinterpreted everything. The old woman who bent down and gave you sugar-covered buns did not love you. You were not loved the way you thought. Of course I still feel an affection for myself. Someone so happy, cute, funny? No, I'm trying to tell you that people hate you. I'm trying to explain to you about the people who hate you. Why do you think that they would all love you? And what do you think they would love about you? What are you? There's no charm in you. There's nothing graceful, nothing that yields. You're simply a relentless, unbearable fanatic. Yes, the commando who crawls all night through the mud is much, much less of a fanatic than you. Look at yourself. Look, you walk so stiffly into your kitchen each morning. You approach your cupboard and you open it and reach for the coffee you expect to find on its shelf, and it has to be there. And if one morning it isn't there, whoa, the hysteria the entire world will have to pay. At the very thought of the unexpected deprivation, you begin to twitch, to panic, to pant. That shortness of breath. Listen to your voice on the telephone. Listen to the tone that comes into your voice when you talk to one of your very close friends and you talk about your life and you use those expressions. What I need to live on. The amount I need just in order to live. Are you cute then? Are you funny then? That hollow tone, the amount I need. Solemn, quiet, no histrionics, the tone of hysteria, the tone of the fanatic. Well, yes, of course, it makes sense. Without, you understand your situation. Without a place to live, without clothes, without money, you would be like them. You would be them. You would be what they are. You would be the homeless. You would be the comfortless. So, of course, you know it. You will do anything. There are no limits to what you will do. Without the money, your face would become the face of a rat. Your hands would be paws, sharp, nimble, ready to scratch, ready to tear. Sure. Sometimes you think about the suffering of the poor. Lying in your bed, you feel a sympathy. You whisper into your pillow some words of hope. Soon you will all have medicine for your children. Soon a home. The heartless world, the heartless people like my neighbor Jean will soon give way, and gradual change will happen as it happened. In Holland in the 19th century. But during this period of waiting, this endless waiting for gradual change, one by one they come knocking at your door and they cry out. They beg you for help. And you say, get them away from me. I can't stand this constant knocking at the door. These people who come with these ridiculous stories, who claim to be my sister, who claim to be my brother all day long, day after day. And so all of these people are taken away and they're made to live in places where they're teased, they're played with, they're lectured, mocked, until a few of them begin to rave irrationally and even laugh viciously. And then, whoa, their vicious actions fill absolutely everyone with horror. And then each one of these vicious people is taken by the shoulders and held down, and their head is shaved, and they're strapped into a chair, and they're executed. And the one they're being executed for is you. Just as it was always you that all those people were talking about so many years ago when they kept on saying, "For our children's sake, we have to do it. We have to set this town on fire, this barn, this hospital, these forests, these animals, this rice, this honey." Just as it's still you, because of how much you love those clean white sheets and the music and the dancers and the telephone calls, for whom all those people with radiant faces are being tortured tonight, are dying tonight. You remember that day in school when you were playing with those three other children and the teacher appeared in the room with four little cakes and gave all of the cakes, all four of the cakes, to that little boy called Arthur and none to you or your two other friends? Well, at first all four of you were simply stunned. For that first moment, all four of you knew that what had happened was unjust, insane. But then your friend Ella tried to make a little joke. And Arthur got furious and he hit Ella. And then he went into a corner and he ate all the cakes. It was an example of someone getting away with something. And your life is another example. It's the life of someone who's gotten away with something. And yet, your fanaticism is so extreme that you won't let that thought come into your mind. Certain things cannot be questioned. The coffee has to be there on the shelf, and no thought may enter your mind if it conflicts with the assumption that you are a decent person. So, go ahead, think. Think freely. Think about anything you like. Think about your health. Other people, the ones who treat you badly. Think about the complicated ways in which you mistreat yourself. Think about the children afflicted with incurable diseases who were interviewed in that magazine. Think of all the things which show that you are decent, which show that those who are like you are decent, your friends, your loved ones, and all those people all over the world in every country who remind you of yourself, people of goodwill who have a little money but believe sincerely in a better life for all. Think of all the things you've done that were kind. Think of the kindness of all your intentions. And if something that you did turned out badly, think of the good motive behind the action. Smile, nod your head, understand, accept. Don't talk to people who don't think you're decent. Don't read books. Don't read articles by writers who don't think you're decent, who don't think those who are like you are decent. The writing is based on a false assumption. It's skewed, distorted. Your thought must be founded on truth, the truth that you are a decent person. Now, a decent person cannot be a person who's gotten away with something. A decent person cannot have what it's not appropriate for them to have. And this understanding of yourself gives you the basis for a view of the world. And so you can look out at the way the world works. And sure, there are many, many things that, of course, disturb you. The situation of your friend Knut, who loves Wagner, but who's so badly paid by his publishing house that he can't even afford to go see the operas he so deeply loves. Or all the examples of man's inhumanity that you see on your television every single night, like that terrible overseer on that rubber plantation in southern Malaysia. But still you can say that the way the world works is fundamentally not unjust, because you've received a share of things which you know it's appropriate for you to have. And if it's appropriate for you to have the share of things which in fact you have, and it's appropriate for all the people who are like you all over the world to have the share that they have, that means that it's not inappropriate for all of the others to have the share which remains. You know that what you have is what you deserve, and that means that what they have is what they deserve. They have what's appropriate for them to have. And you must admit it, the chambermaid is repulsive, ignorant. It's not inappropriate that she should live in hell, because to you she really seems like a creature from hell. She spends her life wallowing in dirt, doing sickening things, disgusting things. Can you picture her returning at night to a sparkling apartment? Or going out later to a meticulous performance? No. Impossible. What would she do with a beautiful hairbrush, a beautiful comb? She wouldn't know how to appreciate them. What would she do with beautiful bath oils, beautiful towels, beautiful soap? Can you imagine her serving her children beautiful dinners with fat green vegetables, fat red tomatoes? No. It's appropriate for the chambermaid to go home at night to that particular hallway on that particular street, just as it's appropriate for you and your friends to spend your lives deciding which products you would like to buy and upholding high standards of performance in art. The way the world works is fundamentally not unjust. So the people who want to preserve the world are basically good, and the ones who want to tear it apart, the ones who steal on the street, the thieves, the destroyers, are basically bad. You, because of your intelligent comments on current films and the thoughtful notes you wrote to your mother's aunt, and because of how upset you were when the waiter in that restaurant brought right up to your table the living lobster that he was going to boil in the kitchen for your dinner, have to be defined as the highest and most admirable type of human being. While Juana, the follower of Marx, who out of some desperate devotion to the people she loves offers up her body to the torturer's knife, can only be defined as the lowest and most reprehensible type, one who deserves the punishment of death. I'm floating in space, holding on to a thick iron bar. Far below me, there's a forest, heat rising up. My hands are so wet, they can hardly keep their grip on the bar. I'm terrified of falling. But a voice says, "Let go of the bar." I hold on tightly, but the voice says, "You won't be hurt. You'll fall safely into the beautiful forest." I let go, drift through space. I keep thinking I should have landed by now, but I'm still falling. A few twigs scratch my cheeks almost gently as I fall. I fall so slowly, the forest held in a vivid silence. Now the bathroom floor, the candle flickering. I lift it, I stand up. I walk out of the bathroom. Now I'm back in the bedroom, leaning against the wall. Put the candle down on a little table. A breeze comes from the open window. I draw a chair to the window and sit. In the street far away, a man cries out. The earth relaxes. The prisoner in the electric chair has suffered and died, and the guards have taken him out to his grave. And yes, there's a wash of blue on the dark wall of the sky, a hint of dawn. It's the coolest hour of the 24. I look out the window, and in the cool breeze, I remember I once was a child in a beautiful city surrounded by hope, and I feel such joy. The coolness of the breeze. I wonder if I could put down for a moment my burden of lies, of lying. Just put it right down on the floor beside me. I wonder what that would be like. Just for a single moment while the breeze blows in, just to put it down. Because I feel so joyful, crazy, naked, free. I want no restrictions on me at all. Dear God, every muscle of my body aches with the effort of constant lying. I'm twisted, contorted, lying from the minute I get up each day till the minute I go to bed. And even when I'm asleep, I think I'm lying. I can't stop because the truth is everywhere. It's in plain sight. Listen to me, my darling. Just let it happen. Just let it happen just for this moment, just for tonight. And then tomorrow we'll go back to lying again as if it never happened. We'll pretend it never happened. We'll forget that it happened. All right. Go ahead. Go ahead. Say it. The life I live is irredeemably corrupt. It has no justification. I keep thinking that there's this justification that I've written down somewhere on some little piece of paper, but that I can't remember what's on the piece of paper, but that it's sitting in the drawer of some desk in some room in some place I used to live. But in fact, I'll never find that little piece of paper because there isn't one. It doesn't exist. There's no piece of paper that justifies what the beggar has and what I have. Standing naked beside the beggar, there's no difference between her and me except a difference in luck. I don't actually deserve to have 1,000 times more than the beggar has. I don't deserve to have 2 crusts of bread more. And then this too. My friends and I were never well-meaning and kind. The sadists were not compassionate scholars trying to do their best for humanity. The burning of fields, the burning of children, were not misguided attempts to do good. Cowards who sit in lecture halls or the halls of state denouncing the crimes of the revolutionaries are not as admirable as the farmers and nuns who ran so swiftly into the wind, who ran silently into death. The ones I killed were not the worst people in all those places. In fact, they were the best. Nothing is changing in the life of the poor. There is no change. Gradual change is not happening. It's not going to happen. It was only something we talked about. My feeling in my heart, a sympathy for the poor, does not change the life of the poor. My believing fervently in gradual change does not change the life of the poor. Parents who teach their children good values do not change the life of the poor. Artists who create works of art that inspire sympathy and good values do not change the life of the poor. Citizens inspired by artists and parents to adopt good values and feel sympathy for the poor and vote for sincere politicians who believe fervently in gradual change do not change the life of the poor. Because sincere politicians who believe fervently in gradual change do not change the life of the poor. The chambermaid's condition is not temporary. A life sentence has been passed on her. She's to clean for me and to sleep in filth. Not she's to clean for me today and I'm to clean for her tomorrow. Not she's to sleep in filth tonight and I'm to sleep in filth tomorrow night or some other night. No. The sentence says that she will serve, and then on the next day, she will serve, and then she will, and she will, right up until her death. But the strangest thing of all, although the terms of existence of the chambermaid were settled at her birth, the terms of my existence were not settled at mine. I say it's not my fault that I was born with a better chance in life than the chambermaid. It's not my fault that I have a little money and she doesn't. But I don't have the money the way I have 2 feet. The money's not a part of me. The fact that I have it isn't a fact about me like the color of my skin. Through a series of events, it came to me. But devoting my life to defending my possession of something that came to me is not an inescapable destiny. Keeping the money is just a choice I'm making. A choice I'm making every day. I could perfectly well put an end to the whole elaborate performance. If people are starving, give them food. If I have more than others, share what I have until I have no more than they do. Live simply, give up everything, become poor myself. I've always loved people who enjoy good meals. People who look forward to watching good performances. Of course I have. Everyone I've ever known is one of those people. I've always been one of those people myself. I've always thought that it's so much nicer to love people who are happy. But the funny thing is that everyone might be. I've struggled hard to get what I have, but my struggle has always been against others. In fact, I've been struggling against the ones who are poor. And from the point of view of the ones who are poor, of course I'm the same as my neighbor Jean. I'm exactly the same, and I'm not on their side. And that, too, is a choice I'm making. I could change sides. I could decide to fight on the other side. The life of a traitor? Betraying my own people? Walking into danger? Very difficult, but a possible choice. If I could accept hardship, accept discomfort, why not suffering, prison, and even? I blow out the candle and swim across the room toward my beautiful bed. Inside my covers, head on the pillow, I swim toward sleep. Next week, home. What will be home? My own bed, my night table, and on the table, what? On the table, what? Blood? Death? A fragment of bone, a fragment, a piece of a human brain, a severed hand. Let everything filthy, everything vile, sit by my bed, where once I had my lamp and clock, books, letters, presents for my birthday, and leftover from the presents, bright-colored ribbons. Forgive me. Forgive me, I know. You forgive me, I'm still falling. Thank you.
Wally, we forgive you.
Yeah.
We forgive you.
That is the shit right there.
That was pretty special, wouldn't you say, Steve?
Oh, yeah. Holy shit.
Yeah, it almost gives me that fever again.
Tell me about it.
I don't know if I'll be able to go out for pizza.
Yes, you will.
Like we usually do.
Don't be a wimp.
I may just have to go home.
Don't go home.
Do you have anything you'd like to say, Mr. Cash?
Thank you for having me. While Sean was great, it is great to hear the homunculus sounding so well.
Yeah, that's right. Well, thanks, Wallace Sean, for being on the show. Sorry, what's that, Steve?
Oh, it's nothing. Let's go get a pizza.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. Okay, well, let's not keep the good listeners up too late. They have to work in the morning. Well, some of them do. Good night, everyone, from The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio.
That's right. Good night, everyone.